The OneStream Global Education Services team proudly presents the OneStream Podcast with your host, Peter Fugere.
Greetings, fellow OneStreamers, and welcome to the OneStream Podcast, where we explore and examine all things OneStream, talk to experts in the industry, and gain knowledge from some of the brightest minds that help deliver and implement solutions for our clients. This episode is part of the OneStream Expert Series, where we explore and examine the fundamental concepts, tools, and topics surrounding OneStream. I'm your host, Peter Fugere, Chief Solutions Officer at OneStream Software. And as always, I'm excited to bring this discussion today, and I'm grateful to welcome Howard Dresner, who maybe needs no introduction, but I'm going to try anyway. Howard is Chief Research Officer at Dresner Advisory Services, an independent advisory firm, widely recognized as an authority in business intelligence and performance management, author of two remarkable books, Profiles in Performance, Business Intelligence Journeys and the Roadmap for Change, and The Performance Management Revolution, Business Results Through Insight and Action. In fact, if you've heard the term business intelligence, Howard is who we have to thank for that. And also a fellow Granite Stater. Howard, thank you for joining and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here.
So Howard, you spent years as a Gartner analyst. How's life been running your own analyst firm versus working at Gartner? What's that like?
Well, it's been liberating in a lot of ways. I mean, I should say I had a great run at Gartner and left on very positive terms. But running your own organization, although it can be challenging at times, it is also it's a lot of fun working with some really bright people and having the flexibility to address the market as it comes at you, right? So really try to get into early topics really early in a way that in a large organization you simply can't do.
And you did a stint as chief strategy officer at Hyperion. I worked at Hyperion then. I remember that. That was a few years before the Oracle acquisition. And how did you enjoy your time working for a software vendor?
Oh, it was intense. I wouldn't have traded it for anything. It was a lot of fun. And also, you know, being part of the executive management team of a public company is a real experience too. Everybody should do it at least once. You know, really being in the hot seat. But it was a great experience.
Good work if you can get it, right?
Absolutely. But it was a great experience. It was a lot of fun. It was certainly exciting. Met some great people. And, you know, being on the vendor side for a couple of years, and I've been on the vendor side before, but it makes you a better analyst. You really have to understand the ecosystem, which includes, you know, vendors, the users, as well as the analyst community. And we're all here to keep each other honest. So being on the vendor side for several years was extremely helpful.
And I sort of hinted at in the open, the little intro here, a lot of people know you as sort of the father of BI, but yeah. what are your main areas of focus now with Dresner Advisory? What are you guys looking at?
Well, so we're in our 17th year, Peter. So a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak. And we started off with a single report. And it's, you know, our research is all primary research. It's all completely independent and objective and inclusive in nature. But we started off, you got to start somewhere, right? So I started off with a single report back in 2010 because we had the internet. I put a survey out there and not really having any expectations about where it was going to head. And it turned into a product. And that was focused on business intelligence. Well, fast forward, you know, over 16 years later, I think this year we're going to publish 22 major market studies, which things like, you know, focus on the Office of Finance has become pretty significant for us. So obviously our Enterprise Performance Management flagship report, that's been in publication for 8 years. We also cover financial consolidation and close management. We cover ESG. We cover sales performance management, supply chain planning and analysis, workforce planning and analysis, and many, many other titles in the technology, various technology categories. And of course, we've had to grow the team. So we have over a dozen analysts now in an organization, over 20, that focus on producing this research for our subscribers.
Let's dig into that because you said a lot of interesting things there for me. But what does your research say about the adoption of EPM software? Has it still been increasing or are we kind of saturated? What's the market look like?
Well, I think if you look at the various large, very large organizations, they've been using EPM probably longer than anyone else. And that maps to complexity. The more complexity you have, the more you need performance management software. I don't know how you would run the business otherwise, right? You certainly can't do it in spreadsheets. I think it's been tried, but it's been a failure. As you move further down in the market, to mid-sized, and there are various, you know, shades of gray there, right? But there is a degree of complexity there as well, and I think that's where we've probably seen the greatest growth in terms of adoption and penetration in recent years, the mid-market. So north of 1,000 employees, you know, typically, you know, I would say upwards of a couple of billion in revenues. That's what I would consider to be the mid-market, and that's been really ripe for penetration of performance management software. At the high end, if, you know, if they're not using it, I don't know what, you know, rock they've been living under, right? That's more of a replacement market than anything else. But the greenfield, that's the mid-market.
You know, it's interesting you said spreadsheets. I remember, you know, if I go back when I started as a junior consultant, you know, and I'd come in on sales calls, it felt like in the Hyperion Enterprise days, I mean, that was the conversation, getting somebody off of spreadsheets.
Yep.
And now it's data volumes. It's, you know, this broader EPM suite. And you said something too, a little off topic here, but I'm hoping we can explore it. You know, Office of Finance and consolidation. What are you seeing in those areas that's interesting?
Well, it's a couple of things that are interesting there. Of course, it's an area that's also been growing in interest, and it maps once again to complexity. And of course, you know, once you have, you know, multiple entities or you're dealing with, you know, multiple countries, you have to use consolidation software in order to make sense of the numbers. And then, of course, financial reporting, you know, there are obviously, you know, even if you're not a publicly held firm, there are reporting requirements in various geographies. And so financial reporting as part of that becomes really important as well. And what's notable, and I remember during, you know, my Hyperion days, if you sold consolidation into an organization, you never sold anything else, right? Yeah. If you started with planning, you might sell more of the stack into that organization. And that's kind of changing. You know, those two things are really coming together where planning and consolidation, you know, the FP&A and the accounting side of the organization are starting to interact more. And so it's, you know, it's something that sometimes now is purchased together. We might start with consolidation and planning at the same time.
Yeah, we've seen that at OneStream for sure. It's, and the product sort of facilitates that a little bit. But I definitely have seen that with some of the projects I've worked on. You mentioned geographies. How does adoption compare versus North America, EMEA, APAC?
Well, I would say that EMEA leads the pack in terms of adoption of EPM software. And that's, you know, it could be, I mean, a lot of that is because of regulation, but also there are some cultural tenets to that, followed by North America. I think penetration is somewhere like 70% in EMEA, maybe 60, around 60% in North America, APAC around 50%. And that's, you know, within our community that's responding. So there are, you know, probably more opportunities in some of those other far-flung geographies because they tend to be somewhat behind EMEA and North America.
What's driving that in EMEA? Is it things like leaseholding and IFRS, that all these reporting requirements are?
Well, there are several things. I mean, I think that, once again, there's much more regulation and consistency around, especially with look at the ESG reporting, with that starting to come to the fore. That's coming out of EMEA and the European Union. It's not coming out of North America. We're going to be late adopters to things like ESG. So I think that in terms of regulation and standardization, EMEA definitely leads the way, and that's what's driving it. It's a necessity, but it's also, I think, a cultural touch point, I think, in many of, you know, the Western European countries to have that degree of regulation and order to running their organizations.
And what are you seeing in industries? So who's leading the charge across industries, and which ones are lagging?
Well, I think that, you know, financial services forever has been ahead of the pack. You know, they are early adopters of many things, but certainly performance management. And in recent years, healthcare has come up very quickly. And that's also because of regulation and because of just sheer complexity. I mean, healthcare is probably maybe the most complex industry, I think, on the face of the earth. I think the laggards would be retail and higher ed, and not because they don't want to. I think it's because of resources. If you look at retail, they operate on razor-thin margins.
Interesting,
and higher ed never have budget for stuff, so they have to make do with whatever they have, right? So I think that it takes them a lot longer to embrace some of these things that, you know, inevitably are going to help them run the organization more handily than they can today.
And what does your research show about barriers to adopting EPM software?
You know, it's It's like anything else, right? Organizations are made up of people. So you have to have management support. It comes down to culture, right? And, yeah. you know, we have this whole thing that we call our hyper-decisive maturity model. And it takes a look at, you know, transparency and accountability and alignment with mission and a whole host of other factors. And so the more mature the organization, the more likely they're going to adopt. But what we see is the greatest impediment is really building a cross-functional team within the enterprise. So, often these things are led by finance, but it can't be finance only. There's a lot of dependencies. The whole organization has to sort of embrace the notion of EPM. And then management engagement. And, you know, I've done case studies in my second book. I did some case studies. And I remember this one organization. It was a large public radio and television entity. And they brought in a new CFO, and he tried to impose strict, you know, budgeting and planning on the creative types. But it was a creative-led organization. And because he couldn't read the room, he didn't last. And they wouldn't embrace it. They wouldn't adopt it. And so I think it needs to be cross-functional. You need to have that management engagement. It's not just, you know, sort of tacit support. It's got to be management ownership of this stuff. This is something that's critical to everyone in the enterprise, right? That's what's going to determine the success of that enterprise, being able to get your head around the data, being able to forecast, being able to plan, reforecast, replan these days in order to properly run the organization.
That's interesting. So what about sourcing EPM solutions? You have research that shows, you know, is there a allegiance to an incumbent ERP vendor, some of the, you know, more general ledger transactional companies, or versus best of breed solutions like OneStream?
You know, you would think there would be much more reliance on ERP where ERP is present. And ERP is not present everywhere. I mean, large organizations, of course, it's fairly dominant, but there isn't across the board, regardless of size of organization, that reliance on the ERP providers for EPM functionality is probably only around 10%. Most organizations want best of breed. They want something that's going to work with their ERP solution, of course, and they all do, but they're not looking to source it from the ERP provider. And once again, during my time on the vendor side, I saw that as well. You know, finance wanted to have solutions from organizations that were dedicated to their success, that really understood the whole finance side of the business. And when you look at the ERP players, they're spread across so many different domains and disciplines that they can't focus all of their energy on this domain in a way which really satisfies the requirements of the CFO and their reports.
You know, that's it. I'm sort of going to go off topic a little bit here, but I want to drill into that a little bit. You know, thinking about my time at Hyperion and companies like OutlookSoft, I think that was sort of a strength. You know, when we talked to customers, I remember that we weren't sort of tied to, you know, some of the big ERP companies. We could get data from multiple sources. You know, it was sort of like a neutral site sort of thing. And I think customers liked that. I think they know they could get data from different places and not feel sort of the stress of that. Is that kind of what you see?
Well, I think at the end of the day, when you look at finance professionals and at CFOs, certainly by extension, They want someone who understands their business as well as they do. And they want someone who's accessible, who's available to them, who's going to listen to them. And when you're dealing with these exceedingly large, multifaceted enterprises, even though they may be well-intentioned and they want to do it, they simply can't. They have, you know, too many eggs in too many different baskets, and they have to balance that all. And so if you have a CFO who has a particular need right now, they can't be as responsive to that. And ultimately, also, when you think about software, what is software? Software is merely an expression of best practice. So if you have an organization that really understands that role and what that role needs to do to be successful, that's expressed in software. Really what they're doing is they're buying the people, the expertise that that organization has that's simply delivered and then supported through that software. And when you look at a OneStream or a specialized EPM organization, well, who are they? They're finance professionals, right? They're not jacks of all trades. You have people that really understand that role as well, maybe better than the CFO does, because they've been in those roles.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, we've had a lot of consultants on the podcast, and especially when we talk about design sessions, we talk about requirement gathering, the most common question I'll tell, I mean, I don't have the research you have, obviously. It's just anecdotal, I guess. But the most common question a lot of people get asked, I keep hearing it over and over again, is, well, what are other people doing? What have you seen? You know, what's your experience with this? And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, they want to know sort of how they stack up with their peers. And that's really interesting that you said that.
Well, and it's absolutely true. And I think that that's why this particular segment has had so much staying power. You know, when you look at technology categories, a tremendous amount of M&A, consolidation, vendors just go away. That's not true in this category because of that a special relationship that these software companies and these solution companies have with the Office of Finance.
Yeah. So let's circle back to something you said, too. We're talking about, you know, budgeting and planning versus consolidation and prioritization of that. What does your research show in terms of priorities for an EPM solution? Where do people want to start when they start this journey? Budgeting, planning, consolidation, or other functions?
Budgeting and planning, top of the list by a wide margin.
Oh, really? I mean, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the top dog. After that, you have things like management reporting, specifically, you know, focused on the finance function. And then consolidation comes in number three. And that wouldn't have been the case, by the way. Consolidation wouldn't have been number three in the past. It's been rising within priorities within the organizations. But at the end of the day, organizations have to start with, you know, with the plan. What's the plan? And when I say the plan, it's not just necessarily the finance plan, although that is predominantly where organizations start and some of them stay there. But even going to other functions that are, you know, sort of glued to the hip of finance, right? Like sales, you got to have a revenue plan. So what's the revenue plan? And that feeds everything else. And in fact, in our world, that's why we've increasingly focused on, you know, sales performance management, supply chain, workforce, because those are also vital to the success of the organization and key to what finance has to do when they're actually developing the plan and the budget.
And we've seen a big shift the last 5 years from on-prem to cloud. And,
yes.
You know, and I'm consolidation, financial consolidation is more my fastball. And I always thought people would be so apprehensive about moving to a cloud with sensitive financial data, their company books, basically. But it's been impressive how much people have adopted the cloud. What's your research show in terms of preference for deploying these solutions?
Well, just to give you a historical perspective, cloud-based approaches to, you know, whether it's budgeting or not as much consolidation, but certainly budgeting and planning, that's 20 years old. It's not new anymore, but it's taken that long for finance to develop a comfort level, because as finance professionals, they're a very conservative bunch, and rightly so. There are serious implications. But I think that over time, it's through education and through adoption, there's a much greater level of comfort with, you know, wholly cloud-based solutions. And only about a third still say, you know, it's got to be on-prem. So that's not gone away. But I think right now the statistics are somewhere north of 40% that are using cloud-based EPM solutions. So it's been a gradual evolution. And I would say that finance, for the longest time, finance and IT were the ones that were sort of, you know, holding back on delivering cloud-based solutions. And finance kind of broke free of that. There, and IT has to some degree as well, right? Because I think that for IT, it was much more traumatic because they had built entire organizations around those on-prem, you know, implementations of software and the whole portfolio. And now it's shifted to the cloud. So it fundamentally changed their jobs. Not quite as much for finance, but finance had some obvious, you know, comfort issues with moving to the cloud. But that's dissipated in large part.
So security is one I think of, but what are the other things? Are there other, do you have research on other issues finance has or had that are sort of dissipating, like you said?
Well, so most notably, putting really sensitive data up in the cloud.
Yeah.
And, you know, one way to deal with that is you do a private cloud implementation, you know, which is kind of like all the benefits of on-prem without it being on-prem. All right. So you're basically using a VPN into that server. And so it's a single instance as opposed to a multi-tenant approach. And I think that, you know, for larger organizations, that resolves a lot of those concerns about hosting that data on someone else's server. And there are, you know, certainly ways to mitigate that. So security, privacy, those are obviously things that are of great concern. But if you look at the breaches that have been that we've seen in the papers, most of them are on-prem systems. They have not been cloud-based systems, and that's because those that offer cloud-based solutions spend a tremendous amount of energy and money and resource securing those data resources to make sure that they're not penetrated.
So let's talk about artificial intelligence. There's a ton of marketing buzz. OneStream's investing quite a bit to enable our platform. Tom, actually, I got to see a presentation of both machine learning and then a large language model, LLM, solutions that we have. It's exciting and it's interesting to see. And I think it's a fun, exciting way. I'm seeing our EPM sort of solution expand. It's interesting. What does your research show in this area? What are people interested in out there?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of interest, no question. But also this whole notion of AI and data science and machine learning is not new. In fact, we've been publishing a report on it for 10 years.
Wow.
And so what has fundamentally, I mean, the technology clearly has advanced substantially. But what has really changed in recent years is the capacity and the ability to process extremely large sets of data in a way that you couldn't do 10 or 15 or more years ago. And so a lot of the techniques are well understood. Neural nets are not new. Of course, there are many more kinds of neural nets today than there were, even 10 years ago. So there is a tremendous amount of interest in this. And within the Office of Finance, once again, you're dealing with a very conservative bunch. And so it's going to take longer for them to develop a comfort level, but we're seeing a change. So, I think even last year, there were more organizations that were saying, yeah, we're not so sure about this. And now we're seeing more organizations saying, yes, we can see that it's going to have a positive impact. And we're seeing more organizations now saying, we actually are willing to be early adopters of this technology. So they see the benefit of applying these advanced techniques to EPM types of solutions, to simplify, to find errors or to correct for errors, because humans are imperfect, right? Machines are much likely to find issues or identify problems before humans will.
And are the requests or the interest for AI, are they general, or are you seeing specific, by industry, by company, certain types of requests for, some of these AI ML functionality? What do you see? What are people really interested in?
What's interesting, what I can tell you is that larger organizations are much more inclined to invest in this. They're likely to invest it in themselves. So they'll have very many of them have a data science function, and they're going to do it themselves. But I would say from an industry perspective, the top industry that's really interested in these advanced approaches would be healthcare. And that's, once again, you're dealing with extreme complexity. And that's not just on the financial side, right? It's also on the clinical side, where they're, employing these advanced techniques for obvious reasons. Once again, humans are imperfect. If you can have, an AI bot, if you will, analyze the specimen or take a look at at an X-ray, it's much more likely to find something than a human would.
And so sourcing these AI capabilities, you said they're, bigger companies are probably looking to invest themselves, or are they reaching out to vendors like OneStream to provide it in their platform? Where are people looking for these solutions?
I would say by and large, whether it's small, mid-size, or large enterprises, by and large, they're going to look to the EPM providers to incorporate that functionality themselves. And so even though you do see some larger enterprises making some level of investment, it's more aligned with other business units or business functions or capabilities. The EPM providers are really the ones that are being counted on to include this technology where it makes sense, to incorporate it to, not to replace people by any means, but to make people more efficient and more productive.
So is that a build versus buy approach that they're taking, or?
Well, absolutely. Well, some cases it makes sense to build it. As it relates to EPM, less so, right? Because you already have the EPM solution, so why would you build something that is adjacent to it? You may be bringing in data that has been affected by those advanced algorithms into your EPM solution. But within the EPM solution, it makes sense to have something that's integrated that understands the context, that EPM context.
And so I know your team's done some research on generative AI recently. let's start with defining that. And then what are you seeing regarding market adoption and interest there?
So generative AI uses neural nets to develop an understanding of language. That's why we refer to large language models. That's what they understand. Yeah. And some of these have been trained, well, they've all been trained on extremely large bodies of information, largely text. And, you know, trained on Wikipedia or things like that, or in some cases, you know, other sources that, that are on the internet. So they have a fluency with language, but they also have a body of knowledge that they can draw upon. And so you can leverage those using things like prompt management to get it to do things for you. You can upload data to it and say, tell me what's interesting about this data. So they're pretty cool. If you haven't experimented with them, you should. There are lots of different large language models out there, and the list is growing probably daily. And so it's not just limited to the big few providers out there, you know, Google et al. Or Microsoft. There are open source large language models too. So it's pretty exciting to see what these things can actually do. And the interest level, so we started surveying our community at the beginning of the year just to kind of put a trial balloon out there. You know, what are you thinking about this? Do you even know about this? What are your inclinations? And based on that, and by the way, back at the beginning of the year, there was a lot of tire kicking. Yeah, we're interested in this. We're playing with it. A lot of people just had no idea. That's changed. We decided to develop it into a full-blown section in our survey, and we will publish a full report on that in the first quarter of next year. But the sentiment has changed dramatically, and organizations are, you know, many more organizations are out there experimenting. Many more than earlier this year are actually implementing things in earnest, actually using the technology. And the reason that it can sort of morph like that so quickly is because there are existing large language models. You don't have to build one. You know, you can use or leverage an existing large language model. And then there's what's known as prompt management. You build prompts around these things and use the APIs to get it to do interesting stuff in the context of your own application. So you can, you know, put a Gen AI interface in front of a body of knowledge and have a conversation with that body of knowledge.
That's interesting. So I'm wondering how does that play out by function or industry? Like, I'd imagine, you know, that body of knowledge, like you said, I mean, that might be accounting principles or accounting questions. And if you have some sort of, you know, question on how you treat some sort of revenue or something, you could ask a question and get a response back. And
you could.
What are you seeing by industry? Are there certain things or like function, well, like legal, accounting?
Right now, I think legal is going to be very, very careful because there is what's known in generative AI as hallucination. And there are situations where I've read accounts where, you know, a legal firm actually used something like ChatGPT to generate case information, which was presented at trial, but was completely made up. It didn't exist.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And generative AI will do that without that prompt management. You know, same way, if you feed it data and say, tell me what's interesting about this data, it might generate something that seems really plausibly like, wow, that's really cool. But if you go back and look at the data, it's unfounded. It's not in the data. It just made it up. You have to look how neural nets work. It's basically a series of connections. So if it finds a connection, it will generate text that it thinks is, you know, is approximate or is statistically correct based on that neural network. And it may not be at all, but it's a mathematical model at the end of the day. It doesn't know. It's not sentient, right? So relax, folks at home. It's not sentient.
AI's not coming for us.
And not yet. It's you know, basically, it's an extremely sophisticated mathematical model. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are lots of interesting use cases. You could have it generate a limerick for you. It does a really good job with that. But there are lots of interesting use cases. But you have to realize there are some limitations. And if you look at who's actually adopting within organizations, which functions, it's IT, it's the data science function, it's research and development, because it's really early days. And those that are implementing it are implementing it in very limited ways, where it can actually do a specific job fairly well. And from an industry perspective, the top three would be healthcare, financial services, and high tech, of course.
Yeah. In those industries, what are you seeing in terms of top use cases?
Well, I'd say anything that's customer facing. So right now you may speak to somebody in a call center in some far flung geography. Yeah. I think in the future, not too distant future, you'll be talking to a generative AI bot. And I don't think that's bad necessarily, because that bot not only will have this body of knowledge and not only will be able to respond to requirements right away, they'll answer the phone or the chat right away, but they'll be connected to the resources that you need. And so once they identify who you are, they can actually service your account much more quickly than talking to somebody on the phone. So, and then otherwise internally, just general productivity. There's just a sense that it'll make us more productive, perhaps allow us or highlight issues that we need to be aware of before we're even aware of it. And it's, you know, once again, as I said, it's a way to have a conversation with a body of information that, you know, whether it's, you know, how to do something within the realm of FP&A or something that's more business specific.
So final question, generative AI has only been, we've only seen it in the market for less than a year now.
Yep.
But what's your prediction for how this gets adopted and the impact it's going to have on finance teams and business just generally?
Well, I think that like lots of technologies, and this one has been fascinating because of the ways in which you can adopt it and the fact that adoption can happen so quickly within organizations. But it's like so many other technologies. I mean, if you go back in history, I've been in the industry for 42 years, right? So, you know, you go back to when, you know, computer graphics, you had to have a separate package to do those, right? Or more recently, you look at things like cloud adoption, or you look at big data. Eventually, it just became a feature. And so generative AI will just become a feature. It will be pervasive. It will be everywhere. So all applications will have a component of it. Applications will get smarter. They even have a personality. Who knows? So I think you will find it in all applications in some measure, including applications which the Office of Finance use.
That's great. This is great, Howard. Do you have any other, do we want to add anything else? Were there other questions you wanted to talk about?
We covered an awful lot of ground, but I think, especially for the Office of Finance, I think it's an exciting time because I think that, you know, when you look at things like, you know, FP&A and accounting, I mean, this is a team sport, right? It's been historically limited to just the finance function, and that's just not true anymore, right? It's something that's going to cross the entire organization. I think when we came through the pandemic, it became clear that, you know, that this capability, the notion of being able to forecast and plan and replan, be crucial to an organization's survival through difficult times. And if you look at the headwinds that we're facing right now, it's even more so. And so it has to involve all of the constituents within the enterprise. It has to involve sales. It has to involve human resources. It has to involve operations and supply chain in order to be successful as an enterprise to deal with a very dynamic and very fluid marketplace. So that, from my perspective, that's what makes this category of EPM and related solutions so exciting right now.
Another great discussion. Thank you, Howard, so much for bringing your expertise to the podcast today. And thank you, fellow OneStreamers, for joining us. Remember, if you like this content, please don't forget to subscribe. We'd love to hear from you. Questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out at podcast@onestreamsoftware.com. I look forward to bringing you another exciting podcast. And until then, take care, and I'll see you next time on the OneStream Podcast.
The OneStream Podcast is brought to you by the OneStream Global Education Services team.